Welcome to Cognitive Rampage Podcast. Hope you're taking care of you. Hope you're living your cognitive rampage. Just a little disclaimer before this show starts, I had to put in, we did not reset the mixer overnight. And for some reason, our mixer decides to change my voice if it's been on for 24 hours in the studio. And I was so excited to start the podcast, I did not double check the mixer and turn it off and reset it and turn it back on. So I apologize for sounding, well, like Alvin from Alvin and the Chipmunks. I squeak the high-pitched thing. If you can get through it, please, please push through, because the competence that is dropped by James Butler today, I enjoyed. It just blew me away. I love his idea of the vision. How big is the vision? That's something that really spoke to me. After James and I got off the podcast, we spoke on the phone afterwards, but it was quite inspiring. He pushed me to pull the trigger on something that I'd been wanting to do for a long time, which is now the Cognitive Road Rampage Tour. And we are pulling out April 10th, doing a 30 days from Orlando, Florida to Seattle. And over 60 days, we're going to encompass or wrap around, if you will, the entire United States. And the first leg goes from Orlando to Denver, Denver to Anaheim, Anaheim to Huntington Beach, Huntington Beach all the way up to Seattle. And we're going to do that in 30 days. And then the second leg will be another 30 days from Seattle all the way across the northern United States, all the way to Chicago, New York, and ending in Bangor, Maine. And that's 60 days around the United States. And what we're doing is I'm setting out to ask the tough questions and to find the real facts and the newest research on how they come up with mental health diagnosis and the treatments of these diagnoses. You see, I believe there's a widening gap in those that discount mental health diagnosis altogether, basically sticking to the theoretical idea that it's all theoretical, and those that use it to label everything and everyone. So we're setting out to talk to the experts at all the major universities along this trek. So we are talking to research departments, labs, practitioners, psychologists, psychiatrists, neurologists, sociologists, biogeneticists. We're going to ask all the questions. What do we know? What are the facts about the top mental health diagnosis? And that's addiction and PTSD, depression and anxiety, bipolar and ADHD. These are the main ones that we're going out to get the facts, get the research right to those professors and teachers that are teaching the soon-to-be practitioners and those that have taught millions of other practitioners currently in the field. So we want to find out. That's what that tour is about, the Cognitive Road Rampage Tour, pulling out April 10th, going all the way to Seattle by May 10th. So if you're along the trek, let us know. I'd love to stop by. I'm giving away all of my speaking services for free. I'm not charging anyone to speak anywhere. I'm not hitting the road to sell books. All I want to do is get the facts for you because I want to know. So, James, thank you for inspiring that and, well, pushing me to pull the trigger, if you will. So I appreciate that, James. You're forever in my debt for that, my friend. Check out his Reclaim Warrior Project, his Reclaiming Warrior Project. We talk about that on the show. But James is an outstanding, amazing, strong individual, someone I'm proud to call a brother now. So, again, I apologize for my voice as this podcast transpires, but please listen more to James, not me. This is my friend, my new brother, James Butler.
Couple things to tell you about before we jump into this badass podcast, and I mean that in every sense of the word, badass podcast. The second edition of the Cognitive Rampage is almost out, almost unleashed to the world. I am so excited about putting this book out. Due diligence has been done, theoretical revision, additions, expansions. Yes, yes, yes. The first edition I love too. But I always like any artist, right? You're not quite done with the masterpiece, I guess, right? So, but if you bought the first edition, it is on Amazon now. I put it at $10. But if you did buy that, send me, email me picture proof, and I will email you a free electronic copy of the second edition, which is coming out very shortly, sometime in March. I'm not really trying to keep it secret. I'm just waiting for that right day. Second, go to drinkmycotee.com. everybody. Facebook, watching live too on the intro. Go to MikeCoT.com, drinkmikeCoT.com, that is. It is pure pH balanced water. It's like 2.5, 2.4. I'm not the guy that measures it. I just like clean water, and it happens to come with mushroom probiotics. You know that's good for you. If you're listening to this podcast, I know you're a healthy person anyway. But yeah, go to drinkmikeCoT.com. Go to, man, I am just in fast forward today. I just want to get to this podcast. It's killing me. Go to drinkmikeCoT.com. And last, but definitely not least, Dollar Mental Health Club is coming out in March. I've been talking about it for a while now. We're always, always pushing this. But the idea is to change the paradigm of mental health, practicing in the present, giving you tools and strategies from multiple coaches on their specialty. It's not counseling, I promise you that. And it's not therapy, right? It's on your time. When you need it, you call, you pick the specialist, you pick the date, you pick the time, we call you. It's just boom, boom, boom. No waiting. You have to email back, wonder what you're getting charged. It's only $1 a minute. Dollar a minute is the best part about that. But dollarmentalhealthclub.com, you can go there now, check it out. We got a little splash page up right now, but we are coming. We are very, very much coming in March. Now, on to the podcast. On the show today is a man that I got to chat with yesterday. I don't know, maybe 10, 15 minutes before we were just like, okay, stop. We have to stop now. We have to bring it back to the podcast. His name is James Butler. He started, that's something I'm going to learn more about, is Reclaiming Warrior and a list of, well, ultimate badass things. That's just it. I'll let him tell you more about it. But James, welcome to the show, my friend.
Thanks so much. How are you doing today?
Oh, I'm in fast forward, man, as you can tell.
It's those mushroom probiotics.
Yeah, it's that or that little bit of caffeine I decided to pump in me right before the show, possibly.
Nice.
Yeah, hit me. I've been kind of solemn. I've been in the book. You know, when you're writing, you know, you get so deep in your own mind that you almost are talking to yourself consistently when you're writing. So it's just always, then you're like, okay, I have to snap out of my own head, talk to somebody else here and focus, you know?
Well, and the worst part is you're like, what do they know and what do they not know? Because I've been on a trail of thought for so long, and they come in about a week later and they're like, what level are you at right now?
Yeah, some of the videos, man, I've been doing, put up, I've got a few responses like, hey, man, you okay? I'm like, I'm a writer, okay? I'm just a writer, all right? We're odd like that, I guess. I'm just using that as a cop-out, but that's really just my excuse. And when a writer is writing, at least from what I've experienced, is we tend to get in some weird places.
Yeah. And then you got to do the due diligence of going back and laying planks so people can get to where you are. That's the fun part.
It is, man. You know, there's so many different kinds of thinkers, you know, the mechanical thinker, the boom, 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 the very straightforward analytic thinker. And then there's, well, the me that is this abstract over here, that if I was building planks, I'd have to have like Kirby pieces of wood that go up and over here, and then like an escalator to bring you back over here. It's all over the place, man. But yeah. So we started out talking yesterday about something we share, something we love, which is the water.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I remember you were talking about freediving. I said, well, you know, I can freedive now because I can't dive anymore, you know, scuba dive or anything with compressed air, anything like that.
Oh, you can't do that anymore at all?
No, my left lung is like destroyed. Shit. That's part of like the backstory that you got to dive into is I got like, My left lung is actually adhered now to my rib cage. There's no pleura space. Like it doesn't slide anymore. And I have about 7 beautiful scars. It looks like stab wounds on my intercostal spacings of my left ribs. And that's from a diving accident when I was with the military. I, you know, one day pass out at a super deep depth, go to the hospital, and they're literally like, I'm leaning over in the emerge and they're lancing my back, doing getting out all the pressure because my trachea, I'm so glad this is on video. So my trachea is actually over here. My belly button was about 4 inches to the right as well.
Oh, you were like, and one of those deformed fish. You reel up too fast.
Yeah, exactly. I was a deformed fish. That is the reframe I've been looking for my entire life.
Leave it to the cognitive reframing master to find the silver lining somewhere, but that's not one, at least the comparison, man. I've fished my whole life, man, and I've reeled up some fish sometimes too quickly, and obviously I wouldn't do it if I'm going to release them, but I've brought them up before quick in a rush, and I'm like, what the fuck kind of fish is that?
Yeah, no, it's just a fish that's going through the bends because the little bubbles of gas just went boom, and expended in their bloodstream.
That's so painful.
It is. Thankfully, what ended up happening was I didn't even know how badass I was at the time, but I had breathed in strep throat about 2 weeks prior, well, about a month prior. And because we were diving so deep, I guess it went through my lung and into the pleura space and started an infection. And 3.5 liters of fluid built outside of my lung. It was like this infectious crap.
Shit.
So here I was, and I was on one of the most intense training courses in the military. Like, we're literally running almost a triathlon every single day. We're in the water, like we're underwater for over 6 hours a day. And my face is going blue. My hands are going blue. And I'm like, man, maybe I'm eating too many cupcakes. Maybe I just can't keep up. No, yeah. I had a collapsed lung. I had a collapsed lung they said about a week. I'm running around with I was pretty fit at the time, but I was running around and my hands would go blue and I was like, man, I'm not feeling good. And then one day my body while diving just said enough's enough. So the muscles between my ribs just completely caved in and I couldn't breathe. And when they went to the hospital, they literally, you know, take a scalpel and just poked my back. And the stuff that came out, man.
Oh, my God, man. Oh, I've seen the YouTube videos reluctantly.
It wasn't like a giant pimple or something like that. It was this stuff inside my lung cavity. And then.
Man, they popped you just like a fish too, man. Oh, my God. You know.
Just like a puffer fish.
Yeah. Before we get too deep and people are wondering what kind of strenuous diving, what is this crazy person doing? You know, what I like to start with usually on the podcast, man, is kind of, you know, your story, kind of where you come from, you know, that environmental influence, what kind of brought you, we'll get to eventually where, what you've been through, what you do now. But what I like to try to do is investigate kind of on my own, perhaps it's the therapeutic background I have, but it's just to kind of learn and see and go, oh, I see how you got there, why you did that, you know?
Yeah. So where do you want me to start?
Wherever you feel, brother. It's your story and your narrative. I kind of like to see how you tell the narrative.
Nice. So through my own self-discovery, I realized that when I was in high school, I thought I was a wimp. I was a bigger guy. I was one of the fittest guys. I was covered in tattoos all the time. And it was this grand compensation for sure.
Yeah.
Because at the time, man, undistinguished, like I thought I was, you know, pick a word, wimp, sissy, all those things. So when I left high school, I said, what's the most badass job I can do? What's the most badass thing I can do? And never, ever have that questioned. Like never have anybody ever say, you know, okay, who are you? And so when I went and signed up for the military, I said, you know, what's the most dangerous job you have? Put me on like the front line and then tell me what the front line's front line is.
Holy shit.
And they told me, I didn't know that I was doing it. I thought, oh, I'm going to do the hero's journey. 9/11 had happened.
That's how they sell it, right? That's how it comes to you, right? Is the hero journey. You're going over there. I get it. It was facing some fears. You're kind of calling yourself on your own shit.
Totally. And I didn't know it at the time, but it was like, I'm going to wear a cape and I'm going to become a man really quick. And, you know, I'm going to go serve my country. And I had no idea what that meant. And so I did this thing called combat engineer, which sounds strange and interesting, but what they don't say is you're the guy that takes the first step in every walk. So when there's landmines or there's IEDs, the improvised explosive devices, you're the guy that has to take the first step.
Holy
shit. You walk
shit.
In front of everybody. You either have the metal detector or a paintbrush or a knife and you're poking the ground looking for bombs while 50 guys behind you are trying to get somewhere. You're the guy that gets them there safe. You're the guy that walks across the bridge first. You're the guy that puts his head in a tunnel first. You're the guy that goes through a door first.
And I thought like,
you're literally like,
I thought like spearing a grouper and reaching a hole, like, and just not caring was intense. Holy shit, man.
No, like, and this was the thing I didn't know. Right. So you think, okay, I'm going to be the most badass guy. And one of my mechanisms of survival is naivety. Like I am like, oh yeah, it'll be okay. So I think, I'm going to be so cool. And I remembered we're on this helicopter landing into Afghanistan. And I was about 20, just turned 21. And the narrative's coming through. And I'm like, man, I am so tough. I'm so tough. Like, look at you. Look at what you're doing.
Did you hear like airfield. The was like a Creedence Clearwater Revival playing as the chopper was coming over?
Man, pick any song. we like, there was red light. We had loaded guns. We're landing and we're like, and you know, people are screaming like, come on, come on, come on, come on. And I remember thinking like, you were the toughest motherfucker on the planet. Like, look at you, look at you, just landed in the front line. And I had this like war journal that I was going to fill out when I was there. And, you know, maybe one day write a book. And the first night we're in this airfield and I'm writing a journal entry that's like, you know, you are tough. Look at what you do. And just totally acknowledging and saying, look how awesome you are. It's edgy to say this, actually. It's really edgy to say this. And as I'm doing that, I hear this beautiful British voice come over a microphone. And it said, excuse me, rocket attack, get down, rocket attack, get down. And what I didn't know was that the Taliban love to lob rockets. And it was like playing bingo. Like, you don't know where they're going to land. Sometimes they go backwards. Sometimes they go right. They're not really aimed. They're just leaning against some sticks and fired off with incense. They use incense as a time fuse.
What the fuck?
And so these rockets come whizzing into the camp. And that night, you know, I'm sitting there, I'm writing this journal, and the voice comes across. I'm like, what the hell is this? So I get down to the ground and I hear like, and these rockets start landing in. And I'm looking at my journal and it's like, you're the toughest guy. And I just close it and it's like, nope, no, you are not.
Oh,
you are, like, that, you have no right to say that right now.
Yeah, you did that sound pretty damn good, man. That was pretty serious, man. Now, does getting on the ground even help?
Well, it's funny because someone once said, you know, if you don't get on the ground, the shrapnel, because the way a bomb implodes, it'll hit the ground and it'll shoot out. And so often there's going to be a collective amount of debris in the first 5 feet, let's say. And then as you get out, the further the trajectory is and more stuff gets in the way. So the theory is that the closer you are to the ground, the more blocks there are around you. And I remember this lady telling the story and she goes, well, you got to get to the ground because one time this guy didn't and he got hit in the ankle. And I went,
well, what the fuck?
If my head was down there, then yeah. That would have been my head. Worst story to tell. But the example, you know, it's like that's the way you get away from an artillery shell or something like that.
Man, I mean, God.
So,
holy shit. That's like your first drop in, too.
And I thought, you know, so when we're in this big airfield at the time, and I thought, like, okay, we're going to stay here. We're going to get climatized. It smells like poop. Like, the air actually has a fecal count in it. Like, there's a fecal count in the air. There's just so much poop in the ground. It's just wild.
What?
And it's so hot. I mean, it's sometimes, like, I'm Canadian, so 58 degrees Celsius was one of the hottest days there. It's so hot that you, like, you sweat and you will, like, take your pants off that will be completely doused in sweat. You'll put them somewhere and they'll dry within, like, 12 to 15 minutes and then be so salted from your own body salt that they'll just stand up. Like,
Have you seen that movie Armageddon when Buddy's just like, okay, worst environment imaginable. You can just say that. You can just say that, right?
Yeah. Well, and I remembered that because we thought we were going to stay in camp, and it was about a day later, they said, no, you're going to go to the front line. And the front line for us was almost near the border of Pakistan.
So this airfield you were at was not even front line?
No, this is the staging.
Oh, geez.
That's where, like, this is like, you know, it's like kilometers big. It's the staging for everything. And then the next day we get in this armored vehicle and we drive out into the land. And here I am, you know, thinking, oh, we're going to have time. And no, it was like, you know, the next morning we wake up, they're like, okay, you're going to go out to your FOB. And a FOB is like some sandbags in a circle. You sleep in the center of a town that's filled with these bad dudes. And at night, they just take pop shots to see if they can get you.
What the fuck? I can only imagine. I can't even fathom the state of hypervigilance your body has to adjust to live in that kind of environment, even for a fucking day.
Well, that's the beautiful part, right? Like, as I, you know, I'll just explain the first day. We're in this back of this vehicle and they're like, okay, watch out for this because that might blow up. Okay, if you see this, this is a bad thing. If you see this, is a bad thing. And they're just hyper feeding you like, this is how you survive. And primitively, you know, you go to the survival mechanism immediately. Like, something that I should have had 10,000 years ago comes back in full force. And suddenly that hypervigilance, like, you know, like it's like your pupils are dilated and you start picking up on everything. The way, like, a rock is leaned different, like the way the water is, if there's footprints, if there's, like, even if, like, there's people and then suddenly there's not people, like, you're tuned into the environment because you have to be a fucking superhero.
You're like a superhero, man.
That's what I didn't get at the time. And that's what, you know, the prelude for everything, because 8 months goes by of this stuff. 8 months of, you know, every single day we're going out and almost every day you're finding a device and you, like, every footstep is calculated. Every door that you open, there could be someone behind. And I remembered at the time thinking like, this is whack. This is crazy. And after 2 weeks, it became normal.
Oh,
like that was life.
Man, I've worked with so many veterans, man. You can see how it comes back like that. I mean, the body has to, in order to survive mentally, the body's got to adjust. Then the mind's got to make sense of all that shit.
Like you've heard of like the hedonic treadmill of, you know, people who get a sentence to prison, they go, oh, my life's never going to be the same because now I'm going to prison, or a family member dies, or even people win the lottery. They think an event in their life means that their life will never change. And after about, honestly, 2 weeks to a month, it becomes that's the new normal. And the interesting part in some of the work that I even find with veterans is like, not only does it become normal, it's the first time in your life you've ever felt fully alive. Because every step you take is life and death. Every, like when you wake up, like you're wearing, everything you wear has purpose. Everything, like every call that you make could be the last, every food that you eat. And I mean, you don't think that when you're there, you're not in the you're not that dramatic. In fact, it's quite fun and it's quite easy. And we're just drinking coffee and wearing flip flops a lot. But coming back, it reminded me of this story I heard about the rate of astronauts that get depression when they come back from the moon. Cause they go, like, how exciting is my life when I was just up there? And there's so many times that I draw back these references, even in the work I do now, where I see that, like, yeah, it was the scariest it's ever been, but it was the most alive I ever felt. And yeah, it was the most, you know, I prayed to come home and actually make it through the days. And yet when I came home, it was like, well, there's this massive void of knowing the human that I was actually capable of being, that I could literally live in a high threat scenario day in and day out, perform, thrive, also work out and get like a massive killer body. But I could actually perform at this level and be this person. But when not faced with the challenge, I didn't have to be that person. And I sunk back into what, you know, society or what our resting comfortable state is, but knowing that that human existed. And that's when the void was created.
Go ahead.
Well, that's when I became present to knowing that there was a human inside of me that, if called forth, could become one of the most powerful motherfuckers on the planet and could literally, like, anything happen, respond, react, move. You know, we watched a helicopter get shot down and it wasn't even a thought in our mind. We just threw our stuff on and ran out. I didn't realize I was wearing Crocs instead of boots. I was wearing Crocs and I get halfway, and, oh crap, put some boots on and off we go. But you just get to this level, well, where you look and you think of, you know, vibrationally, like I'm performing at a 10 and you now know that exists.
Excited. No, it's all you, brother. Trust me, keep interrupting me, man. You go. This show's about you, man. But you're just bringing up so many thoughts for sure for me is, you know, to correlate that to some people about anxiety is, I actually was explaining this the other day to someone, and the idea that people think about anxiety as being nervous or anxious and needing some sort of stimuli to be so isn't true. That actually anxiety stems from a physiological reaction. And then when the mind doesn't realize what's happening to the body, it gets worse and worse and worse. And for you spoke about the veterans that live in this hypervigilant state, come home, the body is acclimated to this state. The mind works to this state. And then when you take that away, the physiological reaction remains. But then the mind goes, what is fucking happening to me? And that's why you get the, more danger, the better, right? They come home and it becomes risky behavior. Yeah. It becomes drugs, sexual behavior, all risky ideas to try to peak to that point, man. What a fucking conundrum. And what a double-edged sword for real is that you get to taste this superhero feeling, which I can't even compare, man. I have minuscule stories about sharks and diving and crocodiles and shit, but nothing about where I'm stepping on mines and rockets. I can't even fucking imagine. And then to feel that, but I mean, it's wild to hear that correlation between finding that silver lining of that superhero that was able to come out there and then trying to cope with that coming back.
Well, I mean, even what you speak to is it's actually a human trait. Like when you look at the great white shark or the lion of the savannah, they have been the alpha, the apex predator for, you know, hundreds of thousands of years. Like they have evolved to be the top. They were the top of the food chain forever. So they actually are, their confidence is an ingrained part of their DNA. Mm. And humans, it was not that long ago that we were the middle of the food chain. So that feeling of needing to survive, like, it served us really well. Suddenly what happens, we became the apex alpha, like, overnight. And we have not lost the need to survive. We have not lost that feeling of, like, something's going to eat me. So we run around with this survival mechanism that we actually don't need. And meanwhile, sharks and lions are one of the highest hunted things on earth, but they haven't caught up to our advancement that we're going to try to kill them. So they're, like, hyper confident. They just walk over and be like, yeah, I'll eat you if I want to. They don't know what a gun is. They don't know what a spear is. And so there's, like, this disparity when you see that, like, the survival need creates this massive, massive disparity between, I have this hypervigilance to survive, but nothing is trying to kill me. And so now humans, we have this hypervigilance, everything all the time, but there's actually no problem. So what do? We create problems so that it becomes true, so that we can use those mechanisms. So we start creating challenges with our spouses. We start putting obstacles in the way. I could literally give my clients every single opportunity and they go, the world is still against me and wants to kill me. And it's not their fault. They've been programmed that way. They've been programmed to look for what's going to kill them. And if it's not there, they're going to start making it up because that's the model that makes sense to us.
Fuck, man. And keep going.
So there's the double edge of that, right? Like, me saying, okay, like, now I got to see even a higher level of survival, which I'm actually going to call, you know, warrior type fighting for. So I got to see that I was capable of even performing, like, well outperforming the mundane, you know, whatever we would call, like, okay, taxes, bills, basic relationship breakdowns, all this stuff. And I knew that I could deal with threats or adversity that was far beyond what the average person would face. So I now understood that, you know, like, if I were to go to Jurassic Park, you know, those people visit the island and suddenly they're being chased around for 30 days straight. And then they get off the island. They're like, man, your problems, like, the fact that Wendy's is out of ice cream is not even, like, I don't care about that. And suddenly they become, like, you know, the gravity of Earth doesn't affect them anymore. They're like Superman or, you know, Dragon Ball Z Super Saiyan training at extra gravity. And if you know that reference, you're a nerd. So, so what ends up happening is I realize coming back from there that, like, the gravity of normal life just does not hold me down. And you can actually reframe that. Like, you can use that as, like, I'm not afraid to cold call, like, the CEO of the major company and pitch my idea. I don't care if he says no. I'm not afraid to go out and do things that are unconventional. I'm not afraid to go out and build my business in a way that, like, is unpredictable. It's uncommon. It's, like, exponential, because I know what real threat actually looks like. And real threat is not hearing no. Real threat is not being rejected. Real threat is not being turned down. It's actually when every single step is left or right. And that capacity, that human capacity, is what fascinates the hell out of me, is that I know that each human being has that capacity to understand what real threat actually looks like. And that when you face that, nothing else can bother you.
God, man. I mean, the only story, I mean, I could go on. We talked a little bit about some diving stories and things like that. But one that's always in the fresh, right at front of my mind, is just, long story short, I was wading and in some saltwater fishing, and I was probably 150 yards offshore, waist deep. And then I was split between land and, well, I couldn't get to land. A nice, probably, I don't know, 7-8 foot saltwater crocodile, which have come into those rivers now, which are pretty aggressive. Decided to make a beeline right for me. And I had nothing but a knife and a fishing pole. And I decided, it came right at me, man. It was just V on top of the water all the way. All I decided to do was cross the fishing poles in the ground and have my little fillet knife going, all right, man, this is all we can do. And in that moment, I had to be honest that it's the most free I ever fucking felt. And as it stops fucking 4 feet, it's like looking at me. And it was like, I think he knew. I was like, all right, bro, you or me, man. And it kind of goes under. And then that moment where it goes under, I don't remember anything. I just remember being so free and just feeling its tail go whip right on my leg and just swam on by. And I was like, whew, okay, you know. And in that moment, those are things I wanted. And I actually went and started a company upstairs right after that called Primal Nature. And I was taking people on tours like that. I was going to Primal Nature things. Zumas Islands was the idea, and all of these. I was like, I got to give people this experience, man. And it's the freest I can ever felt. But it's so hard to tell somebody, all right, go put your life in danger so you can feel more alive today.
Yeah. Well, okay, I'm just going to throw on top of that.
Go, baby.
So a lot of times people look at the adversity that they face in their life, and it's from a place of like, if that adversity wasn't here, then, you know, my life would have been better of some sort. And you look at all of the people, I mean, I'm going to generalize for a second. Anybody who has mental resilience has some story of why they are resilient. They've gone through adversity and it's trained them to be the person that they are right now. You look at like Navy SEALs or any sort of, you know, what you would aspire to say is the highest performing individual on the planet. They were trained to be that way. They actually put themselves through, like they put themselves through adversity and used it to become the person that they are right now. And so it's, how do you train a warrior? You put a warrior through the hardest circumstances on earth so they become more than they ever need to be in real life. And therefore they can survive anything. And so one of the most fundamental reframes that even our society, and this is just my own personal belief, needs is that adversity is the greatest thing that you can ever have. Steps forward, one step forward. You're walking forward and your adversity actually trains you to be more, and you can keep stepping forward. All of the things that have been thrown in your way, any of the upset, any of the, you know, the divorces, the breakdowns, the bankruptcies, have to find the silver lining of how did that make me closer to who I actually am.
Holy and when shit, you do that, man. Tell them, baby.
Man, nothing, like when you actually use adversity as your gift, nothing is actually in the way. Every no that you hear is like, oh, thank you so much. Thank you for telling me no, because now I'm closer to the person that I actually know I can be. Anytime you've got that upset, that breakdown, it's like, oh, thank you for training me to be the person that I am. And I see this with the people that are some of the highest performing, you know, I'm just going to use military guys for an example. The more it sucks, the more they know they're getting closer to their highest level. And so they actually sign up for the suck. They sign up for the adversity. They say, you know, this is going to be hard. This is going to be hard. Thank God. That's actually what I'm paying for. That's why I want to do this, because I know that it's training, you know, and in fitness, for some reason, we understand this, but we don't understand it in the real world. That you go and lift a heavier weight and it actually has you grow and become more capable. And yet we leave the gym and we're like, no adversity. I don't want it to suck. And yet that is the greatest gift that people can give you, is the loving challenge, the push, that like the block, and have you find different ways to be cognitively able to overcome things. How do you train a warrior? You give them adversity and have them become more. And if we can actually reframe adversity, like, you are untouchable. You cannot be touched if adversity is your friend.
Man, we are on the same wavelength with this, man. I mean, I talk a lot about it. You know, the idea that we talk about valleys being valleys when truly we should respect the valleys. That makes us stronger. No one ever got better from silver spoons. And I mean, one of my favorite lines in the book is uncomfortable is where the change is, and becoming the master of the silver lining. These are all ideas. You know, it always still baffles me how someone from some environment that's terrible can go so far, and then so many can choose to accept the narrative from that environment and walk it a totally different route. And the only difference there is the perception of what they're experiencing. You know, they can both experience the same traumas, the same environments, etc., but someone chooses to tell that story and say, I wear my stripes through what I've been through, and I wear them proudly rather than wear them with shame, and almost learn to like love that challenge, man. And you know, I want to kind of go back to your story, man, because we're on the same wavelength. AB LaRoche, thank you for hooking us up, by the way. She was right on point. As you were going through kind of the first initial 8 months over there, could you feel changes mentally? Could you feel your thinking change differently? Was it noticeable even?
Man, physically it was noticeable. Like, I took up more space. I gained, I think, about 15 pounds of like muscle, and, you know, part of more testosterone to operate in that environment. So my body produced more testosterone. I took up more space. We were thinking tougher thoughts. We were actually, like, we embodied the space we needed. And it's something that I love about, you know, they used to tie dogs' tails up and it would make them happy. Or if you wear a smile more, your body produces hormones that makes you happy, because your body actually creates your mindset. And so at the time, I actually felt myself physically getting bigger, and I felt myself physically getting stronger. Like, my bench increased. I think I put like 65 pounds on my bench within the first 3 months. And it was like, I wasn't doing any more. I had the same routine. And then I started to notice mentally just the way that I operated in the world. Like, I literally feel like I left a boy and came back a man. Like, that was the rite of passage that all, like, you know, what I find the masculine really desires is that like, I now give you permission to be a man.
I mean, and is that missing in today's world, in your opinion, that rite of passage? Or is it just this kind of...
I totally think it is. And it's kind of hard because, you know, we go, well, should you need a rite of passage? I mean, I don't know. But I know a lot of my colleagues that work in the masculinity world and like evolved masculinity. We're not trying to get people back to being barbarians, we're trying to get people to be, you know, the honored masculine, the one that actually protects and serves versus, you know, causing shit and destroying. And one of the things that,
which I think is missing in the world, by the way.
So there you go. Because what I often find is like, we're looking for evidence in our masculinity. Like we're looking, and there's a lot of people, they're trying to find that in different ways. So if they don't have that evidence, they try to prove it. And they either, you know, get good looking, get the right woman, get the right job. And it's like a cargo cult where they're trying to do the things that makes them look like what they should have, but it's actually not giving them access to the experience they want. You know, I have the job, I have the title, I have the woman, yet I don't fucking feel like a man. Or, you know, I'm doing the things, I'm pushing the weight, but I don't actually feel secure in who I am. And when people start to point it out, I get defensive and insecure and I push it away because, man, they've got no evidence of their masculinity. And it's a hard thing to actually walk somebody through that, but have them discover like, yeah, you know what? I'm actually not that secure. I don't have all my shit figured out, and have that be completely okay.
Well, how much of that are you speaking to the humility of it, right? Because I think a lot of people tend to confuse the word masculine with a lack of humility, a lack of empathy, a lack of sympathy. But it seems like in order to cross over to this, the neo-masculine almost, as if you're talking about, is almost impossible to do without pointing out where we are flawed to begin with.
Totally. And that's why, like, man, this is not a subject that I thought we were going to go into, and I freaking love it, is it's actually the evolution of what we think masculinity is. That it isn't the cold, stone-faced, barbaric, detached, you know, take what I want and leave a trail of bodies behind me. That's actually not. We're actually talking about, like, if you look even what primally is supposed to be, the masculine is supposed to create safety. They're supposed to be able to create an environment where people can thrive, create a world where people feel safe around them and they feel like they can live their lives and create their lives underneath or in partnership with that.
Hence the lion head of the pride.
Exactly. And so what we're actually seeing is this masculine that's actually making the world feel less safe. We've got leaders that are leading companies where they feel like they can't trust them. They can't, you know, they don't know if they're going to get fired or if they're not. Husbands that wives are like, I don't know what he's doing. Like, I can't relax and build my life with this man because I don't know where he's at. And so what we actually are looking at is the reframe of what masculinity is. And for me, it's service and honor. It's actually you being the person that feel they say like, because that person's here, I feel like I can build my life. And not, you know, they're giving me access to that, but like they've got my back, they're protecting me, and therefore I can go do. And so part of that is like, you know, the evolution of masculinity is they have to know themselves first too. And they have to be willing at looking at what they don't want to look at, the things that they're not secure of, the things that they don't, you know, being able to ask for help, being able to be acknowledged, being able to actually receive, like not always needing to have everything figured out, being able to, you know, distinguish your own insecurities and know that they're not labels, they're just ways of seeing things. And you can actually move them. Like you can control your mindset. Not being a victim of your mindset or a victim of your circumstance. And so when we see the evolution of man, the evolution of woman, when they don't have to be like always replicating power, what we think power looks like, but they can be the powerful feminine as well. And we can actually appreciate their gifts. We can actually use and partner in a way that's never been seen before.
It's almost like partly because you see this disillusion. I mean, I don't want to walk down the road of like, you know, binary and all this idea of masculine. I mean, I get enough emails on that shit already. But I mean, I would be honest to say that there's two things I think are missing in the world is, I mean, could you imagine a world to where, you know, men did walk around looking for that, that picked on the weak. And we've turned into this world to where you just don't look, right? You just keep going, I don't want to be involved, or you turn your fucking phone on. You know, you're watching old ladies get hit in Target. You're watching, you know, every once in a while. Could you imagine, though, if men walked around going, I'm protecting the weak, the elderly, the children. That's just who I'm looking out for. And I think our world is even missing that matriarch woman touch, that real, you know, they love you, they hug you, they understand you, they motivate you. I mean, that combination seems so powerful when you talk about that. But do you think maybe it's just getting lost in this whole idea that nothing means anything anymore?
I don't know about that part. I think that people are confused because they don't have a model that works.
Ooh.
I think that, you know, when we look, the old way that masculinity worked didn't work. So mm-hmm. then you've got the opposite to that, which is feminism movement saying, hey, let us actually have power and right and choice. And then you get that, but now nobody knows what the hell to do. And so you've got this masculinity that goes, well, okay, I don't know who to be anymore. I don't know who you need me to be. And I don't even know what the new model looks like. Is it powerful? Is it choosing? Is it not choosing? Is it taking control? Is it not taking control? Is it doing what I want? Is it not doing what I want? Is it having a mission? Is it having your mission? They're like, it's all from the place of like, well, what the fuck do I do now? You know, it's not that. I agree with you. But what now is it?
And what do and they do? They turn the noise off. They go to the work or do what they do. They drink the Bud Light at that. You know, they just kind of quietly go into the dark night.
Yep. And you start to see it because, like, I'm not going to say this is the evidence, but how many relationships feel sexually neutral? They don't know, you know, they're not like, it's not passion anymore, because what you have is you don't have a strong feminine. And I'm not talking about feminine woman or masculine male. We're actually just talking about polarities, yeah. Polarities and energy.
Yeah.
And so what you actually don't have is polarity anymore, and you've got neutrality. So you've got the world's best roommate where, like, everything's good. But man, you don't feel love. You don't feel fulfillment. You don't feel like when I come home, I want to kick down the door and just, and like be with that person and just like build a world with them and actually build a world from love. You're building a world from like safe and secure and it works and cool. But man, you just don't feel alive. It's one of the hardest parts.
Well, it's that idea maybe, right? This false safety that if I can at least just control in this little environment, I can maintain this little place. I don't push beyond the uncomfortable. I don't take the risk. Fuck, man, this has hit me today for the I love when the universe works for me like that, man. It gets to slap my ass in the face. But I mean, because I would say we all, I think, at one point go through that balancing act of trying to find our place in the world and the relationship and our family, wherever that may be. And trying to, I love how you point out that there's no real model for it. And especially how you pointed out the old models didn't seem to work either, right? It was just more war, more bombs, more, right? It was kind of like, all right, that didn't work. So man, like trying to find that real balance, man, that's kind of what you're setting out to try to bring, right?
Absolutely. And it's, you know, so it's why I called my company Reclaiming Warrior. It's not about reclaiming the badass that can actually go kill things. It's actually about what are you willing to fight for? Like reclaim your warrior, sure. Like reclaim a warrior energy, but for what? Like what are you willing to put your name for, bleed for, die for, sacrifice for, like, you know, sell your house and actually like build a life for? It's finding that thing. Like, I don't actually want you to become a strong masculine. I want you to know, what do you need to become a strong masculine for? Actually want to create in the world, that you have to become a different human being to do. See that pain in the world of something that's missing. I want to know, great, you're who you are right now. Let's play the structure of the mental model of you're not enough. Let's play that for a second. You're not enough. But who do you need to become to actually take that on? Like, you know, what version of superhero or leader? And I'm not talking about just men, but like actually identifying that your life has purpose. Yes, we can all agree with that. Yes, you can identify with a mission and now become the person who can actually take that on. And so what we do is actually support people to discover, like, who do I need to be to take on the shit that I want to change in the world and become a warrior for something, not just a warrior for money, for my own self-interest, for my own little world, but actually being a contributing member of our society. And to your point, could you imagine if every single human being was a contributor to the greater cause and you didn't even have to feel unsafe? If you felt like you could actually just be a part of something bigger and we were all creating together,
Oh, I can hear them now, man. All these hippie motherfuckers with their masculine talk, and now they're talking about love and unity, you know, and God, we'd all work together. Well, there's, I mean, I can hear them, you know, I can already hear them, like, kind of this give up mode, right?
Totally. And how are things going right now?
I love how you deliver it, man. I love that.
Like I hear it all the time, and I say, okay, great. So you want to fight for the status quo? Cool. Let's put all our energy into fighting for right now. We can fight to keep things the same way they are. But are you telling me that, you know, more time than you've ever had? You personally have more fulfillment than you've ever had. You personally have more connection and more community than you've ever had? No. And if you're willing to say, like, well, I'm going to fight for the current level that I have right now, I don't agree with that. And so maybe my model or the model that we're talking about doesn't actually always fit in, but hey, it's still better than what we've got.
So let's go back to the story. We've spent 8 months over there. We were talking about other things you got into, because I'm starting to see how this model's getting shaped, man. I'm starting to see if kind of how my model in the book, Transrational Structured Behavior Theory, if you get into it and then you start to learn my life, you kind of see how, okay, I see how that comes from. So you've take me further, man. So we're on the front lines. What happens there? What are some of the most influential moments that you can remember up to now?
You know, I remembered. Actually, I'm going to plug my phone in because I'm seeing the 10% mark come up. So we're okay with that.
Yeah, no worries.
Can you hear me well?
Yeah, you actually got a little distance when you took the microphone or the headphones out.
I know. I'm not going to shame iPhone 7, but you can either charge your phone or listen to headphones at the same time, but you can't do both at the same time.
And it's supposed to be the fucking advanced. You're going to have to just talk really loud, man, like you're in a stage of 1,500 people with no mic.
Okay, I will talk as loud as possible.
Yeah, because you got really low, actually, brother. You got really low.
Snap. Okay, well, this is what we got.
Well, that's it.
Yeah, this is what we got. So one of the things that actually came up for me there was actually having to weigh your life. Like I remembered I would be walking down the path one day, and there'd be a guy who was older than me. He had had children, and we're talking with each other and we're saying, who should go first? Like, whose life is worth more? You know, you're young, you got your whole life ahead of you. And I'm like, man, you've got kids, like you got people that depend on you. And you actually realize that you're in this place of measuring life, deciding whose life is worth more, because it's inevitable that somebody's going to step on something and something's going to happen. And that was such an interesting time to even look back on now, is like possible, like that you could quantify somebody's life and who was worth live further. If they were to survive, whose life was worth more to society even. And that quantifying your own existence blew my mind to have to figure out whose life is worth more. And it was something that it even fascinates me right now, when you go like, what is the worth of a human being? Was the worth because he had kids? Was the worth because I've got something going off into the future, like a possible future that I'm going to create? But it's not something that we think about in our lives. And yet, how do you quantify your own worth if you don't have to make that choice?
It seems like a lot of humans are just walking around, though, with the idea, trying to quantify their worth. I talk about it a lot, man, that performance doesn't equal value. And so we look for things to perform well at, to assume that we have value, when just the fact our human potential is limitless in value by itself.
What would you create if your value wasn't what you were going for? And I don't mean you personally, but I mean, like, if we weren't constantly trying to create our own value in the things that we do, and it was just inherently like, hey, man, you've got value, you've got it right now, just assume it. What would you then get to go do if you weren't always trying to create or fill the void of, like, I'm going to have value?
Yeah, I would approach that in a few ways, because usually talking to a few people, they lack the idea of any value to begin with. If I'm working with them on that notion, it's okay, I think, to be proud of performance, to be proud of what we do, what we give back, how we do it. These are all good things. But I think to judge the value that we hold based specifically on how we perform is generally not where to start. But I think as we can understand that, remember I said human potential. And so the fact that we have the human potential gives you value, but human potential also suggests that, well, you have potential to do something great, which still requires the do it portion.
Yep. I'm not sure what the exact question was or where to go, but
just keep riding, man. This is a rampage, brother. Well, you were talking about some stories, actually, as we were leading from there, you know, some of the influential stories. I mean, shit, we were talking about the submarine mines that you were pulling from and just kind of those hard stories like the one you just told that you kind of look back on and go, that one conversation, that one dive, that one moment, you know, that may have really kept shaping this Reclaiming Warrior project.
It was actually when my lung collapsed, because from that, I couldn't dive anymore. I couldn't have the career. Yeah, this is the edgy kind of hard part, but like, I was married at the time, that fell through. Suddenly I find myself without career, without the relationship that I identified. Like, I love being a husband. That was, you know, for me, an identity that I had. I love wearing the cape from the job. It was an identity that I had. I was massive. I was shredded. I was at the point, like, you know, I was deadlifting close to 600 pounds, bench pressing nearly like 450. Like, I was a machine at the time. For me, that was my version of machine. And overnight, none. Like, you know, I lost 65 pounds of body weight in 8 days because of the infection. And so I find myself, you know, it was beautiful and it was what needed to happen. The breakdown of the job that I identified, the relationship identified, the who I was as the person.
The performance.
You find yourself without any identity. No performance whatsoever, right? So In the model that we're talking about, so as a human, am I suddenly of no value? No. And this was the shift, because what ended up happening was I realized, well, if I have nothing on my slate, then that means I am in complete possibility. If I have nothing that I'm in right now, it means I can create anything. And I don't have to build on top of something. I can just actually start from scratch. It's like building and saying, well, that one didn't work. How big of a building do you want to build now?
I love the idea. Have you seen the movie Ghost in the Darkness? I'm sure. And he builds that lion trap, and he's and Michael Douglas shows up, Remington. He's like, hey, man, I tried to use that in India. And he was like, yeah, it's a good idea. Did it work? No, it's still a good idea.
Totally. And that, you know, that for me was the, I would say the turning point of the game. Was I realized that I didn't have to keep chasing the dream that I had built over and over and over and trying to make it work and glue it back together and stick it back together. It was like, all right, well, I'm smarter than I've ever been. I'm more connected than I've ever been. I've got, you know, more possibility than I've ever been. Something that I actually want to create. And it was literally, you know, napkin and a Sharpie. I'm saying, what do I want to create with my life? Like, if I could rebuild, what do I want it to look like? And I came up with some criteria, you know, like if I was going to go move into an apartment, I was like, this is what I want my apartment to have. And it was like, I want to be of service to the world. I want to actually be creating. I want to be doing something that's with humans. Like, I actually want to impact humans. Creating this world that I wanted to live into, like, just word by word by word. And it was massive. And it was something I'd never looked at before. And I said, well, okay. And I'm going to be a little bit careful with this. But what I realized was that my worth was not in my performance. My worth was in my vision. Mm. And it was the size of the vision that I was holding and working into that gave me like purpose to keep going. And it was something that, like, for me, it was like, I don't care who I am right now. That's where I'm going. Accomplished right now. That's where I'm headed. And it's, you know, don't judge me by what I'm doing right now. Judge me by what I'm going for. And
I love that, man. I love the addition. I may be, I'll try to remember to give you some props if I use that in the future, which I'm sure now I've now registered in the brain as the addition of the performance versus value theory I talk about. But I love that in the vision. Man, go over that again, man. That shit liked it, man. I want to hear that shit again.
What I, you know, what I realized was like the pull forward of the vision. So instead of constantly measuring where I am right now as like some sort of, is this good? Is this bad? It was like, no, that's where I'm going. If we really like look at it, it has nothing to do with your current worth. It has nothing to do with like your current resources. It is in a created environment or a created future where you say, yeah, I know that who I am right now is not there, but that's actually where I'm going. Getting into the question of like, well, if that's where I'm going, what do I need? That's when people actually start to distinguish the gap. is if all they're asking themselves is, am I good? Yes or no. You get an answer. You get a, am I good? Yes. Am I bad? Yes. Whatever. Nothing is actually created. There's no gap to live into. Whereas what am I creating? Then you get a vision. Then you get a distance. Okay. I'm right here, but this is actually what I'm creating. So now there's actually this void. It's like a friggin' vacuum. So you decide, well, that's what I'm creating. And you go, okay, what do I need to get there? And so you actually are in the seeker mentality. You're in the learning mentality where you're saying, okay, because I'm actually going for something now, now I have needs. Like now I actually have something that I need to start building and something that I can create. So it doesn't matter if I'm a good yes or no right now. That's not the point. I'm now in the mentality of what do I need to get to where I'm going? I built this vision. I said, you know, I'm going to own a company and it's going to be for the betterment of humanity. Tell people, but I'm going to use the listening of your audience, create a little bit of my world is for my life is to create a world where pulling a trigger is not the answer. We can be in conflict. We can, you know, hate each other. We can be angry, but we don't solve our problems by actually pulling a trigger. Mm-hmm. And of killing conflict. And that, like, you know, killing your neighbor is not the answer to solving your problems. And that's not how you dominate and get power and stuff. So that's like the high, the, you know, what I'm, the reason I work with who I work with and the way that I work is actually so we can get to a scenario where it actually works 100% of the world for 100% of people, 100% of the time. So this is a massive vision. And here I am in the hospital, still bleeding out and looking for, you know, like I'm not that person, but suddenly I had a gap to live into. And I started, you know, I worked with a coach. I started aligning myself with the community, started saying, who do I need to talk to actually have this happen? Who do I need to work with? And realized that there was like an entire industry that got built or that would support me. I incorporated myself, built a company, started working with, I said, you know, like the people that I work with, they need to be high impact people. I don't just want to work one-on-one. I want to work with, when I work with one person, 100 people will be impacted by that person. Mm. So the criteria for who I work with is, if I work with you, I will change your life. Yes, I am sure that 100%, but 100 people will also, their lives will also be changed because I work with you. So when I work with, you know, 10 people, I'm not working with 10 people. I'm working with 100 people that they impact as well. So I started getting into the mentality of like even impact mentality. So I'm going to go for value and I'm going to go for impact. What's the highest impact for my activity? What's the highest impact for distribution? And how do I actually do this? And it was literally, man, like step by step, micro choice. But now I was choosing in alignment with the vision, not choosing, am I good right now? Yes or no. Quantifying my own existence. Yes, right now. Which is just a holding pattern that you keep going around and around and around until you fly up your own ass and make a poop noise. It's accomplished there.
Man, I love this idea, the size of the vision, right? You measure the man by the size of the vision. I really dig this, man, because you can really tell, right? When you look at somebody and say, hey, what's your vision? What do you see? Oh, I'd love to have my 401k and have my retirement, my condo in Naples, Florida. And I'm content with that. And I wonder, I'm just posing this question, so don't judge me, people, if that's what you choose to make you happy. Or I'm just posing it here. I mean, is that a cop-out to humanity? Is it a cop-out to humanity to say that I'm content here, so I know the world needs changing, but, well, it's gravity problems, so I can't do that by myself. So I'm going to take care of me and my own.
It's a survival answer. Mm. Even, you know, that line you just said, like, I'm just going to take care of me and my own. Cool. Like, I actually have it that you can. I actually have it that you can take care of your own little space. But there's actually a part where I go, would you do that if you knew you could do more? Like, would you do that if you knew that you could actually impact? And, you know, you go to the motivation theory, which is we are only motivated in things that we think that we can impact the outcome in. Mm-hmm. So if I'm going to the gym and I don't think that my efforts are actually going to create anything new, way. And I'm like, well, why do this? It's suffering, it's pain, and it's actually not creating any result. Whereas if I go to, you know, I start to see result or see result from my impact, you go, holy shit, you know, when I do something changes. And so people actually are motivated that way. So motivation is created. When we can actually impact the result, motivation is created. And so sometimes when I hear people saying, I'm gonna take care of me and my own, and I go, well, okay, if you actually saw the impact that you create, if you saw even the way that you smile at somebody, 10 people in their life, the way that you treat somebody, the way that you say hi to your cab driver, or you say hi to your house cleaner, if you're one of those guys, that has so much impact. And I often think that people have that mentality, and this is just my bias, because they don't have enough worth to think that they have a footprint that impacts the planet. Understand the impact that every single action that they take has extraordinary impact on the planet. One, they would know that they could impact things, they could create things, they could change things, but they have to see their own impact. And if you were to understand that you can actually do something different, would you still choose that? Mm-hmm. And that is the distinction that I would like to make.
Yeah, I think a lot of people are kind of left going, maybe, right? They're left with that answer. I don't know. I don't know what I'm passionate about. I don't know what I can affect. I don't know what I can change. So let me stay comfortable in the things around me that I know I can affect. And they don't push to that crocodile in the river. They don't push to that landmine they're digging up, or that tiger shark you ran into on the reef that we were talking about yesterday. It's more, and let's face it, I mean, a lot of marketing and other things is really just telling you, hurry up and get comfortable. Hurry up and buy this and be comfortable. Once you get this, then you'll be fine. Just be mindful and be comfortable, and don't push yourself to those places.
Oh, man. Do you know how expensive comfortable is? Like, do you know how much money people spend being comfortable? Being comfortable is one of the most expensive hobbies I've ever seen.
Oh, please, please continue, sir.
Yeah. Well, can you still hear me? You cut out for a second.
No, I got you. I was saying, please continue, sir.
Okay. Yeah. Like, so when you think of like the cost of comfort, oh my God, like when I look at anybody, even entrepreneurs, especially, and I think, okay, how much is bold action worth to you? Let's use the entrepreneur where his actions actually create income. How much is a bold action worth to you? You know, you can fill your, let's say this person had a client practice. They could fill their client practice with people that they're comfortable working with, that they feel comfortable approaching, they feel comfortable providing for. And what they do is they find themselves with a full book of business of people that take a whole lot of work and actually produce very little impact for them or their community or the people that they serve. And I go, okay, well, how much is available to you on the other side of discomfort? Like, if you were to approach that person that you actually want to approach, if you were to go after that mission that you actually want to go, what is the return on that? And some of these people, the cost of comfort is millions. Like, making a call that they're afraid to have, costing them, their families, their communities, millions of dollars. Or not actually saying something to a leader that is doing things to our country or our countries that is not serving. Like, the cost of comfort is exponentially one of the most expensive things I've ever seen.
I'll give you three letters called the NSA. How about the cost of that kind of comfort, the illusion of it?
Being a Canadian, back to relationship.
Yeah.
Well, even in relationship, like, so you look at a normal relationship, the cost of comfort of not being willing to have the conversation that needs to be had, or saying the thing that needs to be had, or doing the thing that needs to be done, and actually living on top of whatever tension you feel, like how much that costs connection and love, and even financially, by being unwilling to do the bold thing.
Oh my God, dude, relationships are destroyed every day because no one wants to say, look, this is going to hurt a little bit when we talk about it, and it's not going to be that comfortable, but we got to fucking talk about it.
Yeah. And so for me, it's that distinguishment of it's the cost of comfort.
Man.
And anybody that's watching this right now can go back to like, take a look, like how much is comfort costing me? In my constant pursuit to be comfortable, what is it costing me? And actually look for all the areas that they're being comfortable, they're playing it safe, and look at the other side. Like, if I were to actually do the thing that I don't want to do, what's that worth to me? And it can create change for people that they don't even fathom is available to them.
Yeah, I can even see it from a standpoint where people then begin to buy more material things to find that comfort. The bigger car, or the faster car, the bigger house, right? The more and more things and more symbols, if you will, for look at who I am, look what I've achieved, look what I've acquired. And because of this, you know, I got my own cozy little home. I got my favorite little stuff, right? I mean, we spend money to be that comfortable, to put on that illusion of what we are, what we're not, to build some sort of title. I mean, the cost isn't just financial, as we're saying. It's mental, it's relational, it's love, it's honor, right? We begin to lose self-respect even over time.
Well, that's it's just the thing that people, it's a nearsighted wanting to get through the day and not wanting to poke the beehive too much in certain areas, but unconscious to the impact going on. You know, even when I work with people and I'll do like a workshop, and I just go like, hey, like, you know, it's just simply even like, take a look for a second. How much is comfort costing you? If you were to just look at one area, like relationship is such a beautiful place, because yes, it impacts everybody, but, and it, we have relationship with everything, but it's the one area that we can actually impact. People like not understanding that the relationship can change overnight. Relationship with their work or their business can change just by being willing to do the thing that up until now they've been unwilling to do. It can completely reinvent. Like, you can see a night and day when people are just like, okay, I'm going to do the thing that I'm afraid to do.
Oh man, you're speaking volumes here, man, because we're sold the process, right? I mean, look, as an ex-therapist, look, it doesn't help me to tell you that you can change overnight. It actually keeps my lights on the more you think that you need to keep coming to me for weeks. And I try to explain to people that they understand that you believe what you believe is based on your perception. There is no truth, you know? And if you can accept the fact that you believe what you believe, then once that belief changes, there is no fucking process. But we're so stuck on, like, you know, you talk to people and they go, yeah, I'm working on that. Yeah, I'm working on that. You know, it's a process. You know, people say it about a website too. And I'm like, have you been alive in the last 10 years? Like, you can put a website up in like an hour. And, but you hear that idea of like, well, we're working on the website. Yeah, we're, you know, I'll get through this change eventually, right? The acceptance of the roller coaster of process of change, when really the idea of the truth of what we live today is merely our belief of that perception to be reality.
People don't like to hear this, but suffering is a choice.
Woo!
It's like you, we have.
Nope, losing you a little bit there, brother. We've lost you a little bit there, man. I got to the closet transformers. Has taken you over, I think, man. Go ahead.
Oh, yeah. Just that suffering is a choice. Like the amount of like, I lost my train of thought with that one. Suffering is a choice because you can simply see that we're in one of the most abundant times that we've ever been in. And like, people choose suffering. Like, you look, anything that you have in your world, like you create your world. You create everything that you have, you create your experience even. And so under that mindset, under that model, you can see that like you literally choose through your actions suffering. And it's something, it was a coach named Rich Litvin distinguished. And he said it was something like my perfect system four. And you look at, pick any sort of circumstance or scenario that somebody has, the life that they have right now. And you ask like, what's the perfect system that you've created to have that? Like for suffering, like how are you choosing that on a moment by moment basis? Like, well, I scroll my Facebook instead of reaching out to people that I should actually reach out to. You know, I don't call my family on a weekly basis and actually connect. I'm unwilling to have that difficult conversation and so on and so on and so on and so on. And so
it's
on.
The narrative, right? It's how they tell that story that they're not willing to let go of.
Because they don't, I think that people don't understand that suffering is a choice. It's not a reality. It's not something that you have to endure. Our life is not to endure the current existence.
Oh, but come on, James. I'm gonna be the other guy here, right? But James, yep. My mom didn't love me, and I didn't, you know, my family didn't teach me something, and you know, I don't have the same access to education, and I mean, there's all of these external reasons. I mean, come on, I should be here, right?
Should. Yeah. So we can poke through and like hard hitting. There's two places we can come from. We can be victims of our world or we can be responsible for our world. And you can say all the reasons why the world is against you and why it hasn't conspired with you. Or even like we were talking at the very start about adversity being my best friend. Man, the world has been conspiring with you from the very get-go. You've just been choosing to see the lesson as against you. I mean, man, the world is constantly conspiring for you to succeed. And it, like you aren't as smart, or you haven't been as smart as you've been now because you've never had to go through that. So like being responsible for our experience, being responsible with you, what you do with that information. you look like you listen to, let's say even Tony Robbins, his relationship with his mother. It's just it's a well-known example that everybody uses, but his relationship with his mother is like, yeah, okay. You know, she was addicted to painkillers. She used him as a crutch, and forever, like, he had to be the only one. He learned to be hyper-responsible and create. And so he could go, oh man, you know, the world's been against me ever from the get-go. And he said, well, no, I chose to use that as a narrative for me. You know, my version is that I've got a reading disability. I've got this thing called Erlen syndrome. It means that it's like an ocular focusing. So when I look at the word cognitive rampage, I see CO, and CO is clear, but then the rest is blurry. And then I look at GNI, and then the beginning and the end is blurry. And so I could say, okay, well, you know, I didn't even read books until I was about grade 8. I either found audiobooks or convinced my mom to read them to me. And I could say, you know, who am I to be doing this? The world's against me. How dare I have this reading disability? I should never have done anything academic. And I go, you know what? It actually made me very, very good at processing high amounts of information and simplifying it as easy as possible. And in fact, it had me take a world that I felt actually separate of and learn how to dance inside of a world that I couldn't play by the rules. I actually had to find new ways of existing, new ways of performing in a world where I wasn't able to read the book that everybody else in the classroom could read. So I got really good at communication. I got really good at asking people, hey, what did you learn from that book? I got really good at receiving information and actually using it in a way to benefit me. So had that not happened, had I been given all the gifts and all the capabilities, I wouldn't be the human I am right now. But I have to see the gift in that, and I have to be responsible for the way I take that information and use it in my life. And am I going to use it against me, or am I going to use it to fuel me? Said, like, back, it sounds hippy-dippy, but man, that is the choice that we make moment by moment by moment. Is, am I going to choose this as from the victim's eyes of, oh, the world's against me? Or am I going to say, because of that, I am the human that I am right now, and thank God for it.
Yeah, it is. It's willing to, I think, change that narrative, because it's so hard, right? I talked about the truth in the roller coaster examples. No, I mean, I rode it. I know it's scary. This happened to me. I lived it. It was there. I know how I feel. That's why I was probably not good as a therapist, because my line, when they tell me how I feel, like, I don't give a shit how you feel. I care about what you think. And, you know, that's not nice. That's not lovey, right? It's too kick in your front door psychology, I call it. And, you know, to be able to move past something like that, it's, sometimes I used to get frustrated. I would kind of want to shake them. You know what I mean? Like, you keep telling the same story over and over and over, expecting some different fucking result at the end of it. And then when it doesn't come, it's the external locus of control that jumps in. It's not my fault. I wasn't in the right spot. I wasn't lucky enough. They're the reason I didn't do it. There's tons of research out there, by the way, telling people listening to look up that external internal locus of control and see actually who's happier in the long run with that vision too. But it just seems so comfortable. It's so much easier, James, when I can blame them for being wrong and I can at least say, see, I told you I was a fuck up. Aren't I right? I can at least hold on to that.
Yeah. So then I would say, you know, even just like amongst us, great. Here is your life. We're done.
Bam.
Like, okay, cool. Cool. Here it is. We're done. Like, there's nothing, if you're unwilling to move that forward, unwilling to even see it a different way. And I like, congratulations, you've chosen this. And you know, the loving interruption, that is compassion. Obviously there's different ways to work with people's survival mechanisms, right? Like our survival mechanism is the 5-year-old part of us that's afraid and is like trying to maneuver into the world. So yes, address that person and reach them with compassion. And there may be some planks that need to be laid there, but yeah, meet that person with compassion, but also realize like, hey, you're not 5 years old anymore. You know, often you're a 30-year-old person that knows and can choose and can create and can do anything. It can change their circumstances immediately, but you have to see that. Mm-hmm. So how old are we right now when we're having this conversation, and who do we want to be in that conversation? And honestly, when you call out the best version of somebody and you have a conversation with that person, and they even realize that there is that person, you have a conversation from that, man, that's where you create. You don't create from the disempowering story of what can I have with my limited circumstances. You create from, yeah, okay, I can have anything and I can do anything. So what do I want to do with that? Mm-hmm. But you have to draw forward that person.
Yeah, I think a lot of times we expect something to happen to us, something that would just pull it out of us. I mean, a lot of times people are told that they have this, you know, ability, which I do believe, but I think it's almost that we wait on it, that we have to wait on the world to deliver us from our bullshit.
Where it's a moment by moment choice. You know, there's a context, and I, you know, anybody that's listening, I hope they use it actually. So I often think about the man who summited Everest. I just flown back a week ago. My bags are still covered in dirt and snow, and they're on the side of the corner. And any choice that I have to make right now, I actually think from that person. I go, okay, if I was him, what would I choose right now? You know, as an example of like, do I make this call? Do I not make that call? Do I go to the gym? Do I not go to the gym? And actually choose from a more empowering story than the one that I have, a more empowering narrative than what I have right now. I make a choice from that guy. Like, well, what would he do? He'd do this. All right, cool. I'm going to do that. And actually, like, it changes the trajectory of my entire life because I'm choosing from a designed end state versus the disempowering story that I walk around with right now. And so we can actually, you know, make choices from a more empowering narrative, right now, moment by moment by moment by moment, that you end up as that person.
I'm going to add to that too. The reverse of that a lot of people that I actually did in my life is, you know, some of us have things in our lives that some people want that don't perform as well. And, you know, I had the luxury, if you will, to have that as a parent, if you will. And for years, I complained about how, you know, I wasn't shown this, I was treated this way, et cetera. And now I look at it for years now that this different story, that thank God I had a litmus paper to compare it to of what not to do. You know, if you had someone in your life that treated you poorly or something like that, that the way to be grateful for that is that, you know, there's some people that have no comparison, that at least you can say, all right, that's what that person would do. And like you said, I love is find that empowering narrative and play into that the same way. But if that other person was doing the opposite, you can always go, what would they do? And I'm going to do the opposite of what they would do.
Yeah, exactly. And there's such a beautiful distinction in there. You have the choice. Like, even if anybody walks away from this right now and they go, holy shit, I've got the choice to think from a different place. I can choose a different narrative. Man, if you knew that, like, you're the most powerful person on the planet because you can choose anything. People know that they can choose, and that's the sad part. And, you know, it's like, hey, even right now, like Adam, like, I'm really sorry that that was your experience. I'm really sorry that that was what you had going on. And I'm so glad that you chose not to hold on to that, because look at what you're creating right now.
Yeah, I'm gonna throw a left hook, left curveball, whatever the fuck you want to call it. You know, listening to your story, you know, and talking about being beat down with the lung, you know, missing as being a turning point. I would actually go further back for you, man, and say that I probably would think one of the most influential parts or lucky things that happened to you was being the wimp that you believed yourself to be. Not so much the taking missile fire and the fucking swimming with tiger sharks and all the fucking crazy, you know, Contra shit. But, you know, that idea that you actually faced that first adversity, because at that age, man, we're so many things are much more traumatic and influential to our development at that time. And I think maybe the recognition of what you saw, experiencing what you saw, there was no going back to that guy for you.
No. And, you know, you just gave me something really beautiful there. Like, such an insight is I spent an entire life trying to be the badass motherfucker. And you actually have to be a badass motherfucker to go after those things the whole time. Yeah. And so here's this guy, you know, like, I know that I would not have dove with sharks. I would not have gone had I thought that everything was all good and complete and perfect and good to go. I was always looking for something that I had the whole time. And yeah, like the journey of a wimpy kid. And now
book title, you know, book title.
Yeah. Journey of the wimpy kid. And it's why what I do right now. And it's why, you know, one of the communities that I built is called the Warrior Masterclass. And I help men who don't feel challenged, who feel like, you know, the world actually got easy for them. And they're looking for that adversity. They're looking for a community of people that are willing to call them out and interruption and say like, hey man, you said you were going to do this. Now let's do this. Let's do this right now. And it's this beautiful combination of mixing special forces, executives, and entrepreneurs who are all creating something new, but having it be a community of people. I wouldn't have created that if I didn't need that for my entire life. And I had that, and it was, you know, what I saw that I needed. And now that's why I'm so passionate about doing it.
Oh man. So I'm this last little question for you, man, is sure. for that so-called believed wimpy kid that is out there right now, that may be thinking, I'll never feel that way. I mean, I look at what the social constructs in society tells me as a masculine or a tough kid or et cetera, you know, that moment, you know, speak to that kid, that boy, or that girl that's maybe sitting there that, is going quietly into their dark night.
Oh man, I've had that moment so many times. Like for something, the grown man that I'm working with right now. And I think that one of the models that I wish, you know, when I get that opportunity to talk to those kids is like, hey, just so you know, those guys actually don't have it figured out. They still feel like children, wearing a suit and you know, we're all waiting to grow up constantly. And for him to just to normalize the idea and be like, I get how it feels. I get the experience and I get what it feels like to be the smallest kid on the block. Everything, like, you feel helpless, you feel out of control, you feel vulnerable. And I think it's that vulnerability that if we look at that, like, it's actually okay, man, because you cannot have courage without fear. It's impossible. Courage is having the fear and stepping forward anyways. And you can't have fear without vulnerability. And so for that kid, like, who is afraid of everything, they will experience a toughness, an adversity, and a resiliency that nobody else on this planet has ever experienced. Because the kid who's afraid and goes forward anyways is my goddamn hero.
You're fucking badass for real, man. That is a serious drop in cognitive. You got me emotional, bro. I'm out there thinking about the kid sitting there, like, you know, feeling that kind of wimp feeling, man. That's, you're powerful with the words, my friend.
Thank you, man. Yeah, thanks for the opportunity to say so.
Oh my gosh, man. I love coming across speakers, man, that really got some shit to say, that aren't regurgitating some bullshit and then putting out there how to get rich on some book, man. I love warriors like you, man, that are really out there spreading the message and then have a vision, man, of changing the world on some massive fucking level. All due respect, my friend, and please come back on this show. You want this mic anytime, my friend. It is yours. It is way open for you, man. We're going to be talking a whole lot more.
Think so. Thank you so much. You know, to the people that are listening, like, just be a contribution, man. Don't be a suck to the planet. Contribute to it.
Yeah. Anything you want to put out there, man, Twitter's, websites, I know we were just talking about, but feel free, drop them all in there, man. Cause people go to this man's shit. I'm in supporter. I'm backing him.
Yeah. Well, I mean, the one that I'm looking for the most is the ship is sailing on the masterclass. Like, we are putting together such a beautiful community of guys that are willing to have one of the most intense conversations of their month group, bringing in some of the top level lecturers on the planet. And if you're looking in your community and you're seeing that guy that is purposely putting challenge in his way, like picking fights that he doesn't need to fight, or mowing the lawn in extracurricular or extra patterns because he just doesn't feel challenged anymore. Success comes easy and he's like, alive, that's who needs to be a part of this. We are looking for people that want to play ball and play it in a rough way that is the most authentic, honest conversation to have, because I want people's creations to come to life by pussyfooting around the truth.
Man, sign up even if you think you're a masculine man. Sign up just cause. Seriously, yeah. Where do they go to find that stuff at, man?
Yeah, so go to reclaimingwarrior.com and you'll see kind of the info on some of the different things that we provide and that community as well. And actually, you know, just reach out to me personally, which James@reclaimingwarrior.com. And I may not be the guy for you, but I have all the connections in the network. Whatever it is people are creating, I want them to get the resources they need and the group they need to actually make it come to life. And so if I'm not the person, I'll put you in touch with who is.
Fuck, man. I love being around fellas like you, man. I feel the energy even through this fucking virtual connection, man. We got a, you know, transformer shit going on. I'm like, all right, hey, James, I got to run. I got to take over the fucking podcast world right now. I got to change this chemical incarceration shit with the killing people. Like, I got to get to work right now, man. I love it, man. Yeah. I mean, this is how we reach too, man. You move me, man, and I appreciate you cerebrally moving me, about to physically move me at the same time, and coming on here, and I know touching good people, pushing them to be that ultimate self, man, on any level. I appreciate your work. I appreciate what you're doing. If nobody's told you lately, because I know how it is when you're out there trying to push everybody else, that sometimes everybody forgets you're human too, man. Keep fucking swinging, man. You are making an impact. You are changing people. I love what you're fucking doing. Keep doing it, bro. I see it. Love you for it.
Really appreciate it.
Always, man. We'll talk soon, brother. But anytime you want, man, let me know. The mic is yours, my friend.